the government designs of government, the way it created laws, was designed to make the tribes and groups of South Africa fight amongst themselves and be essentially in constant conflict with themselves. And that was essentially the justification, or the, I guess I should say it like this, it was the necessary justification for the creation of the power of the South African state. And that without their beliefs tied to race, they would not have been able to maintain their territory, and they wouldn't have been able to maintain their system of laws. So it's a radical idea to think that an entire country can be created off of a narrative of essentially racial supremacy. And that system, I guess how this ties back is it ties back to Eurocentrism. That system is a product of Eurocentrism. But the people who created Eurocentrism as a philosophy, as a belief, would never have intended that, would never have designed that. That was never something that they could have seen on the radar. And I have to wonder if we are to kind of do better in the future, what ethical or societal principles we would take kind of as people who live in a post-colonial era that is different from the past. I guess what I'm saying is that the post-colonial questions have really changed a lot of how we in academia, or how academics consider philosophies of progress, and have given us strong reasons for skepticism.
But I want to point out something, which is that, you know, we might think about things in a particular way, being more on the academic side of things and stuff. But it's interesting how the Eurocentric narrative is still quite strong, and talking specifically about colonization and decolonization, specifically in Africa. You know, you kind of get this like reverb, this feedback loop going on, basically, which is, as you hinted at, a lot of the issues within Africa today, especially in the immediate post-colonial era, but still today, were very much created by the colonial system, right? Specifically talking about the ethnic division, which I'm going to say more about in just a moment, but I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we're on episode 5. Is it 5, Aaron, of Progress? 6. Episode 6 of our discussions of progress, talking specifically about 20th century. So getting back to that, basically, in the post-colonial era, there's really no debate that like Africa descended into quite a severe period of violence. But like these relationships and these essentially grudges and resentments and all this kind of stuff, and the weaponry involved as well, were all, you know, effectively importations from the colonial era. And those colonial relationships. But what that did as well, and speaking specifically about South Africa, because obviously that the apartheid state lasted quite a bit longer than a lot of the other colonial states, is that it was basically used as a justification that colonialism was correct, right? Like, look what happens when we're not here, when we leave. Oh, you know, these, obviously, I'm saying this from their perspective, like these savages, those sorts of people, like they go back to just killing each other. It's so violent there. It's so scary. Like when we were there, things were so much better, yada, yada, yada. And that was used by, you know, the Rhodesian state, South Africa, all that kind of stuff, the apartheid. And I think it's still used by people today as kind of a way of saying, oh, well, you know, things were better under the colonial relationships. And there's, you know, that's sort of proof. But the irony is that, like, you know, the situations that are going on today and have been in the last few decades are very much related to the colonial setup and all that. We could go into other examples, but I don't think it's really important. But I think that, like Casey kind of said earlier, we kind of see through that now from like us as you know, individuals like that. But I think that there's still very much a narrative that sort of pushes that whole thing.
I think the last sentence by Samir Amin that he ends by stating that some form of socialism is the only stable and humane political system, although it is far from inevitable. I think that's a very strong claim, and I'm not sure how widely accepted that would be.
Can I jump in on that?
Sure.
I have something to say about that, because we're talking about progress. This kind of relates more to like the theory of progress overall, the comments about socialism, because this comes up all the time. I find when you have discussions around progress, around history, you know, around society moving to some better, brighter future, the one that's always on the horizon. This kind of relates to what we were talking about earlier, that progress has some sort of political, moral component to it. Like, we're moving, like, really what progress is, what it's going to be, is we're moving in this right direction. Eventually, we're going to get there. We're going to get to this place where things are, like, really good, right? It's going to be the social, and oftentimes that's framed as a socialist utopia. Sometimes it's framed as the racial utopia, looking at the states like the Third Reich and that kind of thing, right? But there's always this sort of vision of the future just over the horizon. That'll be the place that we get to. And I think that links back to these notions, these theories of progress that do sort of see history in generally as this movement towards some better, brighter future. And I think that generally takes a lot for granted. It takes a lot about the future for granted. It takes a lot about human nature for granted. And it also takes a lot about history for granted. Right? Like, is there one type of state set up? Is there one type of bureaucracy? Is there one type of communal organization that is like the one that's going to be the best? Like, is that really a thing? You know, if we look at like where people lived the best lives, where they were the happiest, however we would measure that over history, again, going back to what I talked about earlier, like, what about some sort of weird egalitarian, small communal, almost anarchic, like societies that you saw very, very, very long time ago? Most of the post-colonial states were communist or socialism aligned. They were virtually all disasters of one kind or another. Not to be harsh, but that's just the truth, right? And they were unfortunately, post-colonial Africa is full of histories of civil war and strife and conflict. And a lot of it was related to building these utopias that are just over the horizon, which usually just turn into like some in-group, that often the vanguard of the proletariat or the vanguard of the farmers, a vanguard of the tribe, you know, eventually accumulating power, which also brings into questions like, what is the relationship between progress and power as well?
I had a thought, and I'm not sure now if I'm thinking so much about progress as I am about history. Maybe you can tell me which phenomena I've kind of got my finger on the pulse for, but I find it just in the activity of philosophizing about progress comes something more, this answer that socialism is where this should go, could go. It could have been something else, but I'm trying to keep my ears open on about the sort of activity that's going on here, because I think that way we can learn about what it is that we're trying to think about if we examine, well, how is it that we go about learning about this or thinking about this? What do we have to do to engage with this phenomena? Again, I think this might also be a product of thinking about history, because events, you can arrange events in a significant form following one another, and that doesn't necessarily imply a better or worse, whereas progress seems to imply, well, if things want to get better, then it should go in this direction. But it seems to have that overlap there. I just find it significant that that's what happens. And I think Hale is right to hone in on this move, but it has that element as well.
And I think there's, if to say a little bit more about this kind of critiquing the progress narrative and stuff, as Brandon, you kind of highlighted as well, you know, it kind of popped in my head. One thing that I think I often find with this discussion, and it comes up a lot around, you know, the great future, the great horizon, whatever that's going to be, is it's very, I'll make up a term right now, generationally centric, which I mean is like, you know, it's us, like, you know, people, we're here, we're almost at the horizon, just one more big push, you know, and like, we're going to get there. And I think that says a lot about these notions of history, notions of progress, because again, what Brandon was hinting at with history, and particularly historiography, like, we start arranging a narrative and a story that looks a particular way, that acts kind of like a springboard to this great future, And we're the ones, or our community, our place and time is the one that's sitting on the springboard, right? Like, this is the most obvious in the Soviet Union. And it's particularly, like, talking about progress in the 20th century, I feel like it's something that particularly came up in the 20th century with certain political movements, that, you know, the great future, the great horizon, and that, like, we're the ones in the, like, it, like, in the story of progress, basically, we're the most important. We're the ones who are finally going to finish the job. We're the ones who are going to get there. Look at all this stuff that's come before us. We have this special relationship to all these past generations because we're their true heirs, and we're going to go the distance. And I think it's just a very, like, generationally centric and anthropocentric notion of what history and progress actually means.
It is interesting that these 20th century narratives of progress are very politically involved. And we've seen some of this when we've looked at Enlightenment thought and when we looked at 19th century thought. But I don't think we've gone as far as essentially saying this is the ideal political system which we know from history, and now all we have to do is follow the system, and if we don't follow the system, we're likely courting some form of disaster. That type of thinking, it seems to be occurring now, and I do want to continue reading some of this article just because we're going to see another theorist propose their political system as the very best and very necessary, but not quite yet. So continuing, postmodern post-colonial theorists offer a more radical critique of European progress narratives than Amin does. Michel Foucault, the French historian of ideas, is a major influence on the school. Foucault holds that discourses are what constitute and empower the subjects that make history. Thus, he takes discourses as the fundamental objects of historical study. In Orientalism, Edward Said applies Foucault's method of discourse analysis in 18th, 19th, and 20th century writings about the Middle East by British and French novelists, travelers, and academics. At the heart of the discourse of Orientalism is the conviction that the countries of the Middle East lag behind those of Europe and can only improve under the tutelage of Europeans. Said argues that the discourse of Orientalism laid the foundation for the colonial project and supported it once it was underway. In addition to Said, the historians of the subaltern studies movement have adapted a Foucaultian view of history, in their case, to analyze Indian colonial history. They have drawn attention to historical actors they term subaltern. These are non-elite Indians that challenged the discourses of both colonialism and anti-British nationalism by exploiting inconsistencies in those narratives. Although at odds in many ways, both discourses drew heavily from progress narratives. In general, postmodern postcolonialists aim to show that the typical universal history is one discourse among many incommensurable discourses, none of which are without inconsistency. So this essentially rejects the notion that a universal history can be perfect, can be sufficient for knowing whether or not there is such a thing as human improvement. I'm just going to read a little bit more, and then we'll go back for comments. So far, we have seen how the events of the 20th century provoked criticisms of the typical European progress narrative. In contrast, the collapse of communism inspired a minor revival of the traditional progress narrative. In his 1989 article, The End of History, Francis Fukuyama proclaims, "What we may be witnessing is not just the end of the Cold War, but the end of history as such. That is, the endpoint of mankind's ideological development and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government." This article and its companion book, The End of History and The Last Man, endorse Hegelian social theory as Fukuyama interprets it. For Fukuyama, Hegel at once offers an idealistic theory of social change and champions liberal democracy. Fukuyama argues that, according to Hegel, history entered its final phase when the principles of liberal democracy first motivated a world historical event, namely the French Revolution. After that critical point, no more major developments were in store, but instead the gradual spread and realization of the liberal democratic ideal. Of course, this argument was seriously challenged by the rise of fascism and communism in the 20th century and the conflicts that ensued. But Fukuyama, in 1989, was maximally situated to defend Hegel and to argue that these ideological alternatives to liberal democracy were essentially deviations from deeper trends. According to Fukuyama, fascism clearly failed by the mid-century, and now with the fall of the Soviet Union, it was evident that communism was also a dead end. Fukuyama states that the proximate cause of the Soviet regime's fall was its lack of legitimacy with the governing elite. The elite lost faith in the regime because they saw it was ideologically bankrupt. According to Fukuyama, liberalism's great ideological rivals failed in the long term for two reasons. First of all, communism has the wrong theory of economic management and could not provide long-term economic prosperity. Thus, Marx's claim that capitalism was materially unstable proved true of communism instead. Second, following Hegel, Fukuyama asserts that only liberalism can satisfy the human desire for recognition in a stable fashion. So again, we see a theorist strongly endorsing a political system and citing the reason for that as being stability. So stability is necessary, therefore liberalism is necessary. Fukuyama ends his book, I'm going back to reading the article now, Fukuyama ends his book with an intriguing consideration of Hegel's view of war. Fukuyama agrees with Hegel that liberal democracy's greatest weakness is its tendency to produce selfish and effete bourgeoisie types. But he points out that war, at least modern war, is destructive rather than invigorating. He asserts that World War I was caused partly by widespread restlessness, but its result was to devastate rather than re-energize Europe. It may be that those who wish to abolish war are naive, but Fukuyama argues persuasively that Hegel's view of war is equally naive. Now, it might be worth reminding our listeners that Hegel saw conflict, and especially military conflict, in a positive sense with regards to progress. And that's critiqued in this element here.
One kind of critique I have of that, thinking about progress and where society is going, is, first of all, I think about Mark Fisher, who kind of wrote in response much a little later on, talking about Fukuyama. And his ideas of capitalist realism, that basically, you know, the world by and large exists in this neoliberal capitalist sphere. It's a kind of way of being in the world. It's a psychological stance as much as it is material. And it's one that you can't really escape from. There are parts of that that I actually accept, and we're not really going into that here. But one thing that came up to me recently I was really thinking about was how I think this conversation has become much more disseminated. And what I mean by that is that instead of there being like large state forces going against each other, you effectively now have lots of diffuse, small organizations, groups rejecting the kind of neoliberal worldview. And the reason I started thinking about this specifically is because talking about consumerism, I was watching Netflix the other night, and I watched the series on Waco. Always found Waco really interesting. But Waco obviously had a lot of problems. And for those of you who don't know, Waco was basically a cult that was very anti-government and, ended up in a standoff with the ATF and the FBI. And their compound ended up burning down, and most of them were burned to death and all this kind of stuff. It's a big part of American history is in the early 90s. You saw in Waco a very significant rejection of the neoliberal modern American model, right? And although this is a tiny amoeba against the full force of the standard mainstream American state, it was still there. And it was actually part of a much larger movement of these sort of diffuse anti-state, anti-consumerist groups who are kind of like reverting back to, going back to what I was talking about earlier, this like real focus on like spiritual, communal, egalitarian living. A lot of times they're termed as cults. That's probably correct in a lot of instances, but it is a completely different way of looking at the world. And the reason I in part brought it up is what was interesting about this documentary is they actually had some of the few survivors from Waco being interviewed. And these people had almost nothing negative to say about their experience in the Branch Davidian Waco cult still to this day, which is kind of weird. And it's kind of intense. And they were talking about stuff that I was kind of like, oh my God, that's odd. My point is that like they had found a different way of being in the world. They had found a different part of the dialectic. And although the conversation was small and eventually it was effectively burned out, like it was there. And I sometimes think like, you know, is the next stage of that sort of historical progression of like the conversation of who and what we are not going to be one that's so like dichotomous, two-sided? Is it going to be far more diffused? Is it going to be far more splintered? You know, is essentially the neoliberal ideal world going to break down into like a massive spider web of interlocking conversations because like it can't maintain itself forever? I don't know. It just kind of came to my mind like that. But I think that this idea that like history has ended, that Fukuyama puts out, or even that Fisher puts out, that it's like, oh yeah, like we're in this world. You can't escape. You can't get out of it. It's like, well, like you can, there's just no big group to join. Right. But there's all sorts of little ideologies happening that you can pair up with and leave. And whether or not they're actually healthy is a different discussion, but they are there.
If anything, what I'm seeing in this article is that the Hegelian method that kind of states that there is, through these conflicts, we come up with an ideal that is the new ideal, that is the progressive, correct ideal into the future, to add to the idea, the Marxian idea of there being conflicts between different systems in history, and that these systems fight with each other and conflict with each other and interact with each other, and thereby we get something that is neither nothing that has existed today but something new. It seems that both of these articles from the Hegelian perspective, both these authors are trying to say, this is it, right? Like, you know, this is the end of history. This is liberal democracy. It's the perfect society, or the most perfect society we have at the present. And then some people have said similar things over socialist societies. I would say it's a very interesting act of desperation, so to speak, because I think it's strange for a philosopher or a theorist to speak with that much confidence. And maybe that goes to some of the generational themes that you were talking about, Hale, that within certain generations, certain ideas are prevalent or thought as almost being or just so popular that if you don't accept them, it's seen as odd and they're just the normal thing. It's incredibly strange for me to actually think that there are some people who considered political systems to be so perfect that they could be universally applied across the globe. Maybe I'm just a little more humble or a little more ignorant in that sense. I do want to get a little bit into John Rawls, and I don't think we'll get all the way through there. But I do think it's worth introducing some of his perspective. Unlike Fukuyama, John Rawls never argues that the liberal democratic ideal is the necessary endpoint of historical development. Instead, Rawls' first priority is the justification of a particular conception of liberal justice, one that supports basic political and civil freedoms, and also dictates significant economic redistribution. At the same time, influenced by Kant and Hegel, Rawls is concerned to show that the ideal he describes is possible. By this he means that it is reachable from the present, and once attained, capable of lasting in perpetuity. He also intends for his demonstration of a just society's possibility to increase its probability. He claims that the Weimar Republic disintegrated into Nazism because its main players lost faith in the idea of a pluralistic society.
I was just going to comment on the parallel between Fukuyama and Rawls on one sees plurality, the other sees disintegration. Plurality seems like a much more optimistic way to look at it. So maybe Rawls has a bit of a mileage.
Discussion of progress is really interesting, but it's also like as the world has become more globalized effectively in one way or another, you know, the real glue that was holding the discussion together, this discussion that was highly Eurocentric, was highly Enlightenment focused, all this kind of stuff, begins to come apart, right? And it begins to also become much more of a discussion of sort of material and bureaucratic functioning rather than a sort of more personal human movement, if I can say that correctly. And I think that that's really interesting. And what it leads to is, you kind of hinted at earlier, was that the whole discussion gets far more ideological, whether you're ideologically committed in some sense, or if you take this kind of anti or rejectionist view that like ideologies are not going to work in one kind or another. Like that opens up a whole can of worms, but maybe we'll get into the next episode. I've appreciated this discussion so far, though. It's been great.
All right. I've been your host, Aaron Wang. Thank you to my co-host, Hale Rottery, and Brandon Brownlee. I've very much enjoyed this latest episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show on philosophies of progress in the 20th century. On our next show, we'll continue talking about John Rawls, as well as the contributions of environmental thought on ideas of progress. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.
Archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM, talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors, and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show,
and a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of a community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.